Let me also say good morning, one and all. I hope you've been reading the book of Ruth this week. That was where we ended last time, a challenge to read a text at least once or twice every week during the summer, look at themes, get interested in details. We're going to spend weeks yet to come. It's a short book, it's not complex, but it's rich, and we want to benefit from its richness. Today, we face squarely the question of where is God when it hurts, to borrow a phrase from Philip Yancey. Where is God when there is pain and no obvious answer to it, no sense in which the pain is makes sense or can be understood or predicts something good. It just seems awful. And that's been a great historic problem for believers from day one. How can God be both all-powerful and all-good and yet not answer my pleas? Why am I in such awful circumstances if he is who he claims to be? Or why is it happening now? Or why are the unrighteous often in such good circumstances and believers in such bad ones? Or when will it end? Or these questions that come up when we're in the midst of hardship and burdens and we're wondering, where is God when it hurts? And in order to kind of prepare us to start with chapter 1 of Ruth, I want to ask you to take a minute and pray for someone in your life for whom pain and the question of God's presence is real. That combination of hurt, being hurting in the midst of hurt right now, and also wondering, is the Lord faithful? You probably know somebody for whom that's a real thing right now. Maybe it's you. But let's take a minute and sort of go to the Lord with that in mind. Pray for someone you know, and then we'll come back to our text. We'll turn to verse 1 of chapter 1 of Ruth, and we're going to read a description of desolation that lasts for five verses. And the story, of course, brightens as it goes along, but it begins with pain. It begins with sorrow. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi, the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. Both Mahlon and Chilion died. And so the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Verse 1 says, a man of Bethlehem is in view. By the time we get to verse 5, the woman was left on stage alone with the spotlight. I mentioned before, this is in many ways Naomi's book more than it is anything else. And the narrator wants us to see her standing there, having lost effectively everything. We'll talk a bit about some of the details in a minute. This is one of the things that makes, I think, this book compelling and interesting and helpful, is that it tells an ordinary human story about human beings and wrestling with God and going through terrible times, but the protagonists are first one woman and then another, two women at the beginning. A man gets added in eventually, but this is a human story told with women as the ones experiencing it, and that's fairly uncommon in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. But maybe it will help us see what we would have missed otherwise. Naomi's on stage. She's lost everything. Well, let's consider some of the details in those first five verses. What, you know, if we're going to fill out the short descriptive language here. First, it says that these events took place during the time of the judges. Now, the darkest period in all of Israel's history, the darkest tunnel through which the people of God passed was the time of the judges. The conquest of the promised land has ended. The monarchy has not yet been established. And you have a series of corrupt and selfish warlords. Bruce Waltke has changed in his commentary the term for judges, which is a lot of English Bibles will use, and that makes them sound more impressive than they are, you know, like they're smart and well-educated and robed or something, but they were warlords. They were leaders of tribes who were, in almost every case, as I said, corrupt and self-serving. Their leadership was discreditable as it occurred, and they fought against enemies who were worse. So the enemies of God during of God's people during the period of judges were terrible. Their own leaders were also terrible, and some of the worst stories in the Bible occurred during in the book of Judges. I don't know how often you let yourself watch the refugees escaping from Boko Haram or ISIS fighters or something, fleeing poor people with kind of the hard political realities that make you need to run for your life. Well, something like that was what was taking place here. And these people were escaping. In addition to the political circumstance, there is a drought, presumably. There's a famine in any case. The land is not producing. It lasts for 10 years. We're familiar with drought in California, but these folks had nothing like the technology to import water rather from the Sierras or desalinate the ocean or anything that, you know, we're going to make attempts to do in California. The drought was meant poverty. It meant that the land didn't produce. So we have this poor family who's got less now because the land doesn't produce, living in horribly unstable political circumstances. It says they sojourned in Moab. They left not for a place that was welcoming, but to a place of antagonism, mistrust, and hostility. The Moabites were enemies of Israel, historic enemies of God's people, and they went to live among their enemies where they would not have been welcomed, where the scramble for survival was not made any easier by its location. And then the men die. Naomi's husband dies, and her first son dies, and her second son dies. Widowhood, for men or women, losing a spouse at midlife when you hoped for decades yet to come together is terrible. Losing a spouse for the two younger women who have most of their life before them is terrible. But many who have describe human loss and the suffering that goes with it, say that to bury your children is the hardest thing anybody has to do. That your children in a proper world should bury you, bury the parents, but to oversee the end of the life of your sons, as Naomi had to do, is heart-wrenching in a distant place, poor, wondering about the future. This is a very hard start to the book, the story of Naomi, and now there are two women who are also widows who are with her. We are supposed to be sympathetic to anyone who survived these things. We are supposed to care about this person that we're now seeing displayed before us. We are supposed to be understanding of the heart that she's going to make some hard statements and kick against goads and not make it easy on herself or anybody else, but there's reasons for that. And the reasons are kind of what she's had to go through. So we're supposed to be sympathetic, but not with rose-colored glasses. We need to look clearly at this person and why and how and what God does for her and how it unfolds, and that's our responsibility going forward. So let me continue now in verse 6. Then she, that is Naomi, arose with her daughters-in-law, to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord visited his people and had given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law. They went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, each of you return to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. They said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, meaning kissed her goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. So what might we see in these verses, this powerful interchange, this story of these women? And again, most of our focus at this point on Naomi. First, I don't think we can help but notice the powerful love relationship that exists between the mother-in-law and her two daughters-in-law. It is expressed in what they say. It is expressed in what they do. It is expressed in their emotions. They have been given to one another, knit together in a powerful way. And I think what we ought to recognize is that suffering and love go together. On some level, the deepest experiences of love are only possible in a context of shared need and shared brokenness and shared sorrow. Suffering and love always go together. It's a line from a Paul Simon song, an old song, that if I never loved, I never would have cried. Maybe so. Maybe without love, you have no tears, you live alone. But if you ever do love, you're going to cry, and your tears expressed honestly will invite others to love you and you them. These women loved the same men. Naomi loved her sons. The daughters-in-law loved their husbands. And they lost, they experienced the same loss. And in losing what they lost, they realized there's somebody who loved the one I loved. And that built a bond between them. Naomi wishes she could find a way to give them a new marriage. I wish that, you know, it's impossible, but one of the things that makes her sad is, "I can't do more for you. I wish I could do more for you, daughters-in-law of mine." Love peels off the facade. Sorrow peels off the facade. It breaks us. It when we're hurting at a deep level and we don't know how to do anything except be hurt, people will see us as we are. And when we are known as we are often in a position to have relationships that go deep. And so that's all that's happening here, all that's happening, I think, between these women. When Leslie and I were being given some counsel before we were married, the pastor who was marrying us was talking about different things. But one of the things, lessons he said, is, you know, talking about how does love last a lifetime? And you start out, you fall in love, romance is in the air. You know, I can't imagine anything but just endless love. But, of course, there is more to learn. And one of the things he told us is, over time, as you raise children together, you will learn to love each other in a way that you wouldn't under any other circumstances, because there is only one other person in your life who loves your kids as much as you do, who will stay up all night with them when they're infants, who will diaper them month after month as they're growing, who will be in pain over their pains, who will cry over their tears, who will long to fix the stuff that they're doing that you can't stop them from doing. Only one other person in your life will love your children as much as you do. And it's because you love them together, you'll find yourself with reservoirs of love that wouldn't exist otherwise. It's the hard stuff that you go through together that creates love. And all of that, or at least some of it, is in play here. These people care for each other deeply because of the suffering they had to go through, the shared suffering. And we run away from, we often don't want to put ourselves in circumstances to be hurt, but sometimes the hurt is what's best for us because of what it produces. Second thing I think we could observe in this, the verses I just read, is that Naomi is effectively, to use New Testament language, effectively a fragrance of life for her daughters-in-law. She was one, and probably her husband and sons as well, we don't know very much about them except that they lived for a while and then died. We don't know hardly anything about them. But on some level, the family of Israelites who moved to Moab became a conduit of grace, so that as Ruth will say later, your God will be my God. She found out something about the God who gave great laws of righteous, a God of righteous character who gave laws that were had health and healing in them, who made promises and kept his promises. The God of Israel somehow made himself known through Naomi and probably her husband and sons. Even though I don't think we should expect to think of Naomi as a terrific Bible teacher who sat down every night with her daughters-in-law and read the Bible to them and taught them, or an evangelist or an apologist. I don't think it was that kind of imagery doesn't work at this time in Israel's history. They weren't proselytizing anybody else. They were just trying to be who they were. But in being who they were, somehow these young women had found out about a God they would never have known otherwise, and they're attracted to him. Again, Paul says this phenomenon is like a fragrance. You don't intend to be influential. Fragrance often is something you don't even hardly notice at first until it's made some change, and it's opened your thinking, and it's ushered in something new. And somehow or other, and I think even in her anger at God, Naomi was teaching these young women about the character of God when she was ticked, because he could take it. He was the kind of God who would let his people lament and cry out and shake their fist and stomp their foot and ask hard questions and walk away and come back again. The way she related to God and spoke about God was attractive to her daughters-in-law. She prays for them effectively in these verses. May God grant you a husband and a future. He is the Lord of all. Nothing happens except by his command. The local deities aren't going to give you anything you need. It is the Lord God who will or won't give you. Now, he may not give you a husband, and I'm a little, we'll see in a minute, her ability to believe anything good about herself is gone. But at least I'm asking that he might do something good for you, because he does good things for people. And so she's managed to pass on to these two young women confidence that she is headed back to the land God promised her people. She's going to make her life there. He is the kind of God who hears prayers, and so on and so forth. She's become a fragrance of life to these women, and given the opportunity, they would cling to her, and one of them succeeds in clinging to her. However, what is missing in Naomi's prayers? What is missing? The love relationship she had with the girls was, I think, beautiful, is beautiful. The fragrance of God's presence is beautiful, but there's something about Naomi that's tough. And what's missing is this. She had come to the point in her life where she believed that God could do something for everyone else, but not her. She never once, by this stage of her life, in the verses we have, prays for herself and her future. May God grant you to have a husband. She can't pray for her own future. And it's not hard to see why, is it? She nursed her husband until he died. Was at his hospice care at the end of his life. she nursed her first son, and she prayed for her husband, "Lord, save my husband, save my son, save my son." And he never did. And so she's done asking. She's done asking for herself. I went down that road. It's too hard. I'm just going to toughen up and kind of make it on my own. And God will do whatever he's going to do. Maybe he'll be good. Maybe he won't. No one knows. I'm not asking anymore. And she prays for others but cannot pray for herself. I think we see a couple of other things, just I'll mention in passing, about Naomi's worldview at this point. And that is, she could only believe in a certain means by which God could be good. They lived in a world in which a woman and children needed a man. There is no other way to survive except that you have a man as your protector. That is the only way. Now, we said last week, it turns out she's going to need to rechange her thinking, because God's going to give her a daughter who will be better to her than seven sons. And it takes her a long time to figure out that there is not only one way that God will be good to his people. But at this stage of things, she could only see one path down which blessing might come. And she can't see any. It is completely bleak down that path. She will need to have her view of the goodness of God expanded, and it will expand, and she will have, you know, all of that's coming yet, the changes that occur in Naomi. The other thing that, she goes on and on about the mechanics of how do you get a husband, how do you get a son, how do you get a, the only thing she can see is this one version, and she's given up on that. Finally, I think, and this is similar, but Naomi is the kind of personality who has been, I think we can see up till now, and it gets much clearer in chapter 3, who is at the center of things, who makes things happen. She's, in some ways, we might say, a prototypical Jewish mother. If there is chicken soup to be made, she's going to make the chicken soup. If there is a family council to call, she's going to call the council. If there is a wider world to engage, she's going to figure out how to do it. She's going to make her family kind of be what it ought to be by dint of her own kind of big personality, decision-making energy, and so on. And that, as I said, in chapter 3, once they turn the corner and there's a little bit of light out there somewhere, Naomi takes charge again. By gosh, I'm going to figure out a way to get this done for you, my dear, and so on. She's that kind of person, and she has to give up being that kind of person. The one who gets to be at the center of everything. Eventually, God's going to act with her being quiet instead of her being active. And that's hard for her, but it's important. She's got to change in order for God to be good to her. And she doesn't know that yet. She doesn't know how to get there yet. But the Lord knows how. So let's continue on to verse 15. And here we get to hear Ruth speak. And now her personality, her heart, her insights come into play. She said, "See," this is Naomi speaking still, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Important, I think, to make a couple observations about what Ruth doesn't say. She doesn't say, "I'm going to go with you because I'm pretty sure I'm going to get a husband if I go to Judah. I know you're kind of down on the whole prospect and you don't think you can have any more kids, but you know, I'm pretty sure it's all going to work out for the best if I go there." She actually has completely agreed with Naomi's analysis. There is no reason in the world to expect a good thing of this particular kind. When I show up in Judah, I am going to be an outsider, a foreigner, an enemy Moabite girl, young woman. I'm going to have no money, nothing to offer a husband. I'm going to be, attached to another poor widow. I will show up with not one single thing that would make me desirable to anybody else. In addition, there's a little bit of a background possibility that, and I think it's worth wondering whether or not she's barren. We don't know how long she was married to Machlon before he died, but if that had been 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years in the midst of this 10-year stint, they hadn't had any babies. You know, maybe that's part of my problem too, is I'm not able to have children. So I'm going to go with you, and not because I think it's going to work out for the best in the story we're telling each other, but I'm going to go because I have been impressed with the God of the people of Israel. Your God, I expect to die with you, and you know, you can look forward to death, but not anything else specific, but she wants to be in the midst of the people who know the living God. And it's interesting, once we get to chapter 2, we'll get here next week, Boaz, when he's later able to speak to her, he understood what she was doing better than she understood it herself. He says this, "The Lord repay you," it was verse 12 of chapter 2, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." She thought she was staying committed to Naomi. Boaz understood that at a deeper level, she was seeking refuge under the embracing wings of God. She was hoping in God in ways, "Your God shall be my God." That meant more than she even understood herself at this point. And there's a powerful image there of seeing the living God as a, Jesus said he was like a hen that wanted to gather its chicks under her wings. To see God as covering over those he loves, drawing them near to his heart, imparting warmth to them. There is tenderness in this image of that she, as Boaz could see, and even though she could not, was seeking God to be good to her, touch her heart, understand her fears, maybe dry her tears, all of that. And what's striking about that is how different it is from the God that she would have known growing up. The chief deity of the Moabites was Chemosh, who was worshipped mostly in an idol that was a furnace with an open mouth. A burning furnace with an open mouth in which you would sometimes place your children in sacrifice. That was the God, the image of God that she would have had in her early days. And now she's seeking refuge under a bird with its wings, drawing it her near to his heart. It's a profound change for her. I told you last week we moved from Palo Alto to Mountain View, and in the course of it, it turns out, I don't remember this happening before, but there was a dove that made a nest in this precarious place that we had to move a bunch of stuff and spray water and do it. This poor little dove sitting on its eggs, 3 weeks at least, it seemed like. And we're trying to do all this. Oh, no, we don't want to hurt the dove. And how are we going to get that out of there? You know, poor thing. But you'd watch this faithful mother bird sit on these eggs, and then pretty soon there were little doves there, and the mother's sitting on them, and she, you know, she'd get scared, but she'd come back. She would protect these things. And of course, there's a tragic end to this story in that I think our neighbor's cat actually killed the little bird. I'm sorry, it's just, you know, it's one of those things. But up until that point, it was this very cool story about a dove taking care of its chicks. And that's what Ruth somehow has been able to believe about God. And we live in a world that is in which the gods of Moab are everywhere. The market forces that will devour you. People trust in them. They don't know there's a God who embraces them. The technological advancements is filled with winners and losers, but losers lose and are swept aside. Political correctness, you know, demands a certain obedience and gives no life in return. Vague spiritual yearnings for some kind of spirituality that is not personal is not life-giving. There is nobody, the kind of the spiritual wanderings of many of our contemporaries don't lead them to a God who puts his arms around them or his wings over them. It leads them with nothing. And we have the opportunity to, in circumstances like knowing someone like young Ruth, perhaps, in which we can, by our speech and by our actions, by our community, by the fragrance as well as the words, invite people to know a God who loves them personally, by name, with tender concern. So we're going to stop here now. They're off to Bethlehem. Naomi and Ruth, who will not be denied, are going back. Naomi, because that's where she needs to go. That's her roots. That's her people. She goes without expectation. Ruth goes because she loves Naomi, but also with some notion that somewhere, somehow, though the future looks completely bleak, if you ask me to analyze the future, it's bleak, but something else is going on for her. Some seeking and finding, as next week will take us into the finding of what she found. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for these intrepid women, these stories of both faith and wrestling and suffering and your secret presence at times, even when it was unseen. We pray that you'll encourage and change us in Jesus' name. Amen.